Well, welcome. We're glad you're here. This is the first event we've done as Trinity Fellowship in what, Dan, 2.5 years? So, yeah, a long time. So we were a little fearful, about the crowd, and you guys did it. So thank you for coming out. We're really excited about our speaker tonight and the question the panelists and you will have for him following the address. So let me introduce you to Professor Ted Davis. He's a distinguished professor of history of science at Messiah University, and there's a footnote to that, emeritus, because he actually retired in May. And now he and his wife are just traveling the country, and they traveled here, and we capitalized on their presence. Another part of Ted's story, and his wife's, Kathy, you're over there, is they were students here. He was a student here. And when they were here, they attended what was then called ECC, now Christ Community Church. And they attended in the old sanctuary down there when Dave Ferris was the pastor. That goes way back. Yeah, way back. And Ted and his wife are good friends with David and Carol McKay. And so it's just it's a wonderful reunion for some of them. So thanks for coming. Just a few words about Ted and his background. Ted is the affiliate fellow in Department of History and Science, or History of Science at the University of Oklahoma. He's a fellow of the International Society for Science and Religion with Michael Hunter. He edited the works of Robert Boyle, which is his specialty, 14 volumes. A separate edition of Robert Boyle's great treatise on God and Nature, a free inquiry into the vulgarly received notion of nature, Cambridge University Press. And Ted just gave me an update today when he looked at this CV. It appeared the last time I checked that they were going to reissue an edition of anti-evolution pamphlets of Harry Rimmer. And Ted tells me they have sent the first copy to him, so it's out there. So congratulations on that. Recently, a completed book about religious activities and the belief of prominent American scientists from the period between the two world wars actually has been accepted by Johns Hopkins University Press, and we're looking forward to some of those. But the one thing that most of you might be interested in, because most of you, like me, are lay people when it comes to science, Ted is currently writing a book about Christianity and early modern science aimed at general audiences, which would include me. So thank you very much for addressing those of us who know nothing about this subject but want to hear from you. So thank you very much. And with no further to do, let's turn it over to Ted. Thank you for being here.
That I need, Bob. Well, thank you, Bob, for extending the opportunity for me to address an audience back home in some ways for us here in Bloomington. My wife has not been back to Bloomington since we left in 1984. So you can imagine it doesn't look the same. Those of you who've lived here the whole time, you know what I mean. Some places we didn't recognize. Other places still look the same. We still remember when the hardware store was on the square downtown. That's how far back we go. And Bob Knight was the basketball coach. And I saw Isaiah Thomas and his team play in the regional finals right here in Bloomington, because in those days you could do that in the NCAA tournament. Only the final four you didn't get to host at home. Okay? So they did that. And I saw Steve Alford's first year. So I was and still am an IU basketball fan. We've had many, many good memories of Bloomington and this church. Our first daughter, Beck, was baptized in this church. So I'm also grateful to John Beggs and Michael Hamburger, who will be on the panel tonight after they've had a chance to hear this paper. Now, the paper itself needs a little bit of background explanation before I jump into it with the next slide. Dan, could we have the lights out here, please? Yeah, I think you'll all want the lights gone overhead.
That's it.
Yeah, thanks. Normally, when I either speak to my own students, which I did for a long time, in class or speak to an audience outside of class, an audience such as yourselves, I would not normally have a script. I would normally have just my slides. This is different. I'm actually going to read most of this as a text. I'm going to do that fairly slowly and digress now and then. It's because the original context for this presentation was a formal academic debate. And I did not want to go off script in that formal academic debate. And I still think this paper works best that way, as a formal statement. So I'm going to go through it with you. It was originally done for a student debate society called the Socratic Club at Oregon State University. And that's a club that had, it's a club that encompasses many of the religious organizations on campus, including the Mormons, including the Hindus, including the Christian groups, and also the campus atheists. So they would bring speakers in to debate points of theism, non-theism, of various academic discourse type things. And that particular evening, my debate opponent was a local secular humanist minister who was designing chips for Intel in Portland. So that he's no longer living, but that's the original context for which this was written. It's a little longer in this form than it was then, and it was limited strictly to 20 minutes. This will be about a half hour on the nose. So it's not going to be that long. But it's going to sound maybe like a formal paper. That's really what it is. But let me begin by showing you my favorite picture of God the Creator. God is always depicted traditionally as an old white guy. I guess I can relate to that a little bit. But this is from a 13th century illuminated French Bible. That is an illustrated, handwritten, hand-drawn diagrams in a handwritten manuscript copy. Since today it's in the Austrian National Library in Vienna. And it depicts God the Creator in the beginning with the mathematician's compass that you can see. You normally think of a compass as something you might use to draw circles with, and indeed you can. But it's primarily in the history of mathematics a measuring device. You can fix it for a certain distance, you see, and you can use it to measure things and have a fixed unit you're working with. And that's what God's doing here. God's making a spherical universe with an unformed earth in here, the sun and the moon not yet done, being placed in the firmament around it. That's what's being depicted here, basically the opening days of creation in Genesis. But God is depicted as a mathematician, and that's going to be a prominent theme of what I'm going to talk about tonight. It's an idea heavily influenced by Neoplatonism. I think that Plato's influence on medieval universities was profound, and this reflects that. But it also reflects certain currents in the biblical tradition, as I'll be getting into tonight. So why do I think Christianity is good for science? Well, sadly, the public conversation about religion and science today is often dominated by shrill, uninformed voices who demonize and insult their opponents, marginalize alternative views in an effort to polarize, and bend the truth until it breaks. We can do a lot better than that. As a historian of science with particular expertise in science and religion, I have a different view of this than many other commentators. Although the historical landscape is not entirely absent of conflicts involving religion and science, the general picture is substantially unlike the popular conception of ongoing inevitable conflict that is promoted by certain preachers of atheism. Quite the opposite. I will argue that Christian faith often complements the picture of the world coming from the sciences, helping us to achieve a deeper understanding of both the way the world is and how we should go about understanding it, while providing a powerful motive for investigating nature. The Christian doctrine of creation helps us to understand more of reality than science alone can study, including the very possibility of doing science itself as a form of knowledge about nature. Now, the tone of my position is no less important than the content. I'm not trying to show that every open-minded, well-informed, rational person must draw the same conclusions that I draw. There are no slam dunk answers to jump shot questions. And questions about the existence of God, the intelligibility of nature, or the meaning of life are of just that sort. The enormous success that science has had in explaining so many features of the natural world is partly a result of limiting its methods and scope to things that can be measured and tested against nature, deliberately leaving all other matters to one side, but not debunking those other matters as meaningless. Now, many of you probably have heard of this person, Richard Dawkins, the Oxford zoologist and popular science writer, who's among the best science writers in the world, I would say, when he sticks with science. But Richard Dawkins would vehemently disagree with the point I just made about science not debunking other matters as meaningless. In a Christmas lecture, ironically, that he gave at the Royal Institution in London about 30 years ago, he asked himself rhetorically the following question: what is the meaning of life? And this was his answer. If science has nothing to say, it is certain that no other discipline can say anything at all. Now, the arrogance of such a claim, dismissing in 17 words the significance of all art, music, literature, and everything else that any person has ever thought about that question, apart from science, is staggering. However, Dawkins doesn't really speak for the whole scientific community when he says such things. He speaks only for himself and those who happen to agree with him. For a different opinion, let's look to the late Peter Medawar, a Nobel laureate biologist who, like Dawkins, did not believe in God. Here's what Medawar said in a fascinating book called The Limits of Science. The existence of a limit to science, he said, is made clear by its inability to answer childlike questions having to do with first and last things. Questions such as, how did everything begin? What are we all here for? What is the point of living? It is not to science, therefore, but to metaphysics, imaginative literature, or religion, that we must turn for answers to questions having to do with first and last things. It is to a few of those first and last things that I now turn. I'll start with a famous statement from the greatest scientist of the last century, at least in my opinion, Albert Einstein. Einstein said a lot of fascinating things. One of the ones in which I have the greatest possible interest is this one. The most incomprehensible thing about the world is that it is comprehensible. Einstein was referring implicitly to two different aspects of nature, its regularity and the fact that our minds can delve deeply into it, producing a coherent picture of reality. Both of those things, the regularity of nature and the fact that we have the ability to comprehend a lot of that, are prerequisites for the very possibility of doing science at all. And those two things, the regularity of nature and the fact that our minds can comprehend a lot of it, happen to match perfectly the biblical notion of creation. Now, what exactly do I mean by creation? It's an idea that might easily be misunderstood if I don't spell it out. Well, here I'm going to enlist a professional theologian, Christopher Kaiser, a Reformed theologian who until recently, just like me, he's recently retired, taught theology at the Reformed Church Seminary in Holland, Michigan. And he has also has a PhD in astrophysics. So Kaiser understands science as well as any theologian alive. And here is how he defines the doctrine of creation. The basic idea of creation in Scripture, he says, is that the entire universe is subject to a code of law, which was established at the beginning of time. This idea has two major implications for our view of the world. One, nature functions with a high degree of autonomy. That word autonomy in English derives etymologically from words that mean having its own laws. Having its own laws. The other feature is of the doctrine of creation is that the natural world is comprehended by God and is therefore comprehensible to human beings created in the divine image. This is what a professional theologian tells us is what the doctrine of creation actually teaches, that these two things are the case. Now, I lack time to expand on Kaiser's claim with specific passages from the Bible and the great theologians. Suffice it to say this, that the term lex naturae, a Latin expression meaning law of nature, lex naturae, or Greek equivalents of that, appear very early in Christian thought, no later than the 4th century, when Ambrose used it in his Latin paraphrase of the treatise on the doctrine of creation, known as the Hexameron, by the great Greek theologian Basil of Caesarea. So this is in the Latin version of that. The Greek version has a Greek equivalent of the term lex natura. Christian theologians made the concept of law of nature commonplace long before scientists picked up the term. Now, precisely because it has such strong theological overtones, philosopher of science Nancy Cartwright, a prominent atheist, has even recommended that scientists stop using the language and concept altogether. Stop talking about laws of nature. She doesn't like that term because of its powerful theistic implications. She even has said this, and I think she's right. Without God, there cannot be laws of nature, nor anything else with their crucial characteristics. Now, Cartwright's conclusion flatly contradicts a widely publicized claim by astrophysicist Lawrence Krauss, a self-described anti-theist. That's the term Krauss uses to describe himself. According to Krauss, advances in cosmology and particle physics have, quote, made it clear that there's a plausible case for understanding precisely how a universe full of stuff, like the universe we live in, could result literally from nothing by natural processes. And therefore, he says, we don't need a creator. Now, frankly, this is nothing but bluster. Krauss's pronouncement goes far beyond science, immersing him in philosophical and theological waters that are much deeper than he realizes himself. David Albert, an atheistic philosopher of physics at Columbia, deftly exposed Krauss's astonishing naivete in a review in the New York Times, where he concluded that none of Krauss's ideas, he said, amount to anything even remotely in the neighborhood of a creation from nothing. Physicist Paul Davis is equally unimpressed by claims of that sort. As he says, it is all very well proclaiming that the laws of physics plus the cosmic initial conditions explain the universe. But this begs the question of where those laws and conditions came from in the first place. Science may be powerfully successful in explaining the universe, but how do we explain science? Why does science, based on the notion of external laws of physics, work, and work so well? Now, many of these natural laws are expressed mathematically. Hardly all of them, but many of them are. And so many, in fact, that the great astronomer James Jeans once famously said that as our knowledge advanced, the universe begins to look more like a great thought than like a great machine. This feature of the universe also has strong theological overtones, leading countless Jewish and Christian scientists to quote a creation text from the Book of Wisdom. I'm not sure about this, but I suspect it's true. It may be the case that the most frequently quoted verse of Scripture on the part of scientists in the Jewish and Christian traditions is actually not from the Jewish or Christian canon. It's from or the Jewish or Protestant canon. It's from the Catholic canon. It's from the Apocrypha. It's in the Book of Wisdom. It's a text in the Book of Wisdom that says this: Thou hast ordered all things in measure and number and weight. I say this might be the most widely quoted scriptural text in the Jewish and Christian traditions on the part of scientists. It is not simply the fact that the universe can be understood. There's more to it here. Something else even more remarkable is going on, something about how we understand it. Many years ago, Nobel laureate Eugene Wigner wrote a famous paper with a fascinating title. If you're an academic in a STEM field, you may have heard of this paper. It's called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences. That's the title of the paper. You can easily find it online. It was written around 1960. Here's what he said. The enormous usefulness of mathematics in the natural sciences is something bordering on the mysterious, and there's no rational explanation for it, he said. With mathematics, we can probe very deeply into matter and far out into the universe in ways that are completely unanticipated and yet incredibly accurate. Wigner put it like this. He said, the mathematical formulation of the physicist's often crude experience leads in an uncanny number of cases to an amazingly accurate description of a large class of phenomena. And he concluded by saying, this shows that the mathematical language has more to commend it than being just the only language we can speak. It shows that it is, in a real sense, the correct language. Now, when I was an undergrad a long time ago at Drexel in Philly, I had 3 6-month full-time internships. All Drexel students do that. 5 years is an undergrad degree. And you spend a year and a half, quote, in industry. In my case, I wanted to be an astronomer, which didn't happen, but I ended up working as an intern at NRAO, the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, which is in Charlottesville. They're the people that built the VLA telescopes in New Mexico. They were designing them then when I was a student, and they operated the Green Bank telescope, the one that fell down in the late 80s and was rebuilt with the premier radio telescope in the world, probably, the one that's there today. I stopped there on the way here last week and saw it for the first time. It's a marvelous instrument. It's higher than the Statue of Liberty or the Great Pyramid. Okay, it's 450 feet high. Well, when I was working there, one of the people I worked for was Seth Shostak, who in those days was a galactic astronomer. Today, he directs the SETI project in California. Seth doesn't believe in God. But he ultimately is assuming something, in my view, about the transcendence of mathematics and the idea that he can pick up a signal coming from some distant source that has evidence of intelligence in it, something that nature alone cannot produce. As cosmologist John Barrow has noted, the whole SETI project assumes that mathematics is a universal language. That's how John Barrow puts it. Carl Sagan obviously thought that was true, judging from his novel Contact, which became the film with Matthew McConaughey and Jodie Foster, you may have seen maybe 20 years ago, in which extraterrestrial beings make their presence known to us by using the prime number sequence. This, of course, could only be possible if mathematics is the same at other times as well as in other places. So here's the bottom line. The seemingly universal presence of mathematics in nature is a profound fact about our encounter with the universe, and it cries out for a deeper explanation. If mathematics is merely a human invention, and our minds are nothing more than the product of a blind evolutionary process that guarantees only our survival, not the truth of our mathematical propositions, then why do our equations describe nature so well? It's the same question Einstein was asking in a different form, isn't it? As Paul Davis has observed, survival, he means an evolutionary sense of survival, survival depends on an appreciation of how the world is, not of any hidden underlying order. Certainly, our survival cannot depend on the hidden order within atomic nuclei or in black holes, or in subatomic particles that are produced on Earth only inside particle accelerator machines. All of this suggests that mathematics has some element of transcendence about it, suggesting in turn the possibility of a transcendent cause of the match between mathematics and matter. Is it perhaps the case, as James Jeans thought, as Kepler thought, as Galileo thought, as Copernicus thought, that God is a mathematician? Which I opened. Well, here I'm with physicist John Polkinghorne, who just recently passed away about a year ago, who says there is no a priori reason, no prior reason, why beautiful equations should prove to be the clue to understanding nature. Why fundamental physics should be possible. Why our minds should have such ready access to the deep structure of the universe. It is a contingent fact that this is true of us and of our world, but it does not seem sufficient simply to regard it as a happy accident. Surely it is a significant insight into the nature of reality. Okay, that's a lot to handle so far, isn't it? Well, let's give up mathematics now for a little while and take a different direction. Whether scientific laws are mathematical or not, whether they're quantitative or qualitative, scientific laws summarize an enormous body of observations, giving them conceptual shape while helping us to predict the results of future observations. They arise out of the interplay of reason and experience that lies at the heart of modern science. Although few scientists today seem aware of it, there are actually deep connections between theism and the idea that we ought to learn about nature first and foremost by observing it, rather than in abstractly reasoning it through. Living at a time today when we're confronted with extraordinarily speculative claims about an inconceivable number of undetectable, unobservable universes, it's worth remembering something that Galileo said in his famous dialogue on the two chief world systems, where he has a character speaking for himself who addresses his opponent in the book, and he says, "Our discourses must relate to the sensible world and not to one on paper." In our own day, the great cosmologist George Ellis, I would propose that George Ellis as a human being is one of the greatest human beings of his day and in science. He was, for his work against apartheid in South Africa, he was awarded the Medal of South Africa by Nelson Mandela. But he's also the author with Stephen Hawking of the standard textbook on general relativity. And he's a devout Quaker of a traditional type. He believes in God. Ellis has said exactly the same thing as this in response to Caltech astronomer Sean Carroll. Sean Carroll wrote an article suggesting, recommending indeed, that we should accept multiverse ideas even without being able to test them empirically, testing them from evidence. And as Ellis points out, Carroll is basically saying that the rules for doing good science have changed if we do that. Ellis says, this is moving the goalposts. Instead of belief in a scientific theory increasing when observational evidence arises to support it, he suggests that theoretical discoveries alone bolster belief. But conclusions arising logically from mathematics, says Ellis, need not apply to the real world. Experiments have proved many beautiful and simple theories wrong. Now, one vestige of the theology underlying the modern scientific attitude is the presence in most scientific papers of two English words, facts, F-A-C-T-S, and data, D-A-T-A. They come from Latin words meaning made and given, silently reminding us that the facts pertain to the things God has made, and the data are given to us by the author of nature. To take this further, I'm going to call on a Jewish scholar in my own field from the last century whose influence on my field, the history of science, especially here at Indiana, which was a premier department at the time I was here 40 years ago, has been nothing short of profound. Indeed, the scholar I studied with at Indiana, the late Sam Westfall, was a great disciple of Coiré, Alexander Coiré, whom he never met, but he was constantly quoting in his lectures. Probably no one scholar did he admire more than Alexander Coiré. Well, reflecting thoughtfully on the foundations of Newton's ideas about the universe, Isaac Newton, Coiré said this, "As we see, empiricism, which means the need to have observations as the root of your science. Empiricism and metaphysics, and even a very definite kind of metaphysic, the creationist, are closely linked together. What other means, indeed, but observation and experience can we possibly use for the study of a world that's been freely created by an infinite God? In other words, you can't tell God what to do. You got to go out and see what he did. That's basically what Coy Ray was arguing, and Coy Ray was 100% right, in my view. Now, during the scientific revolution, that's the period from Copernicus to Newton, when modern science emerges, there's a great debate then that takes place between two ways of looking at the world. One group is known by historians today and philosophers today as the empiricists, the people who believed in observational evidence and its primary importance. And the other, the so-called rationalists, who thought the human mind alone, they actually went to that extent, the human mind alone is sufficient to figure out how the world works. You don't need any empirical information. It can all be done with pure philosophy. That rationalist camp included people like René Descartes and Baruch Spinoza and Gottfried Leibniz. They held that reason alone is enough to discover the laws of nature themselves. In fact, I'll remind many of you who may have studied at some point Immanuel Kant, that Immanuel Kant in the 18th century, the famous German philosopher, believed that Newton's laws of physics were a priori truths. That is, they were absolutely true in all possible worlds. Reason alone could prove Newton's laws. Okay? So this was a common way of thinking in the 17th and 18th centuries. The empiricists, on the other hand, people like Francis Bacon and Robert Boyle and Isaac Newton, they held that you cannot do science in an armchair. Observation and experiment are essential components of the process of understanding nature. That irreducible difference of opinion between those schools of thought shines through something that Leibniz told the Dutch philosopher Christian Huygens. He said, Mr. Boyle spends far too much time to be truthful, drawing from an infinity of splendid experiments, no other conclusions than those which he could have taken for principles of nature, which one can certify to be true from reason alone. For his experiments, no matter how numerous, cannot prove. Leibniz is basically saying, Boyle wasted his time developing the modern scientific laboratory, which is really what Boyle did, and doing all of those experiments again and again and again, when he could have just gone straight to the chase with reason alone. That's what Leibniz was saying to Huygens. Well, today, the scientists, I think all would say, virtually all anyway, say that Leibniz was wrong about this. But there was an issue then. It was a debate and it was a theological component. So let's see what the theological component actually was. What did Christian theology have to do with that difference of opinion? Well, to see this, let's go all the way back to the ancient world and look at the great Greco-Roman physician Galen. He was the personal physician to Emperor Marcus Aurelius in the 2nd century AD. And he was by far the most important influence on Islamic, Christian, and Jewish writers all the way down into the early modern times. Galen wrote more than 100 works on medicine, many of which have been lost, but a lot of which were still preserved. Galen compared the Greek notion of God and creation to that of the Hebrews in the following terms. Galen said, for Moses, he says, it seems enough to say that God simply willed the arrangement of matter, and it was presently arranged in due order, for he believes everything to be possible with God. We Greeks, however, do not hold this. We say that certain things are impossible by nature, and that God does not even attempt such things at all, but that he only chooses the best of the possibilities of becoming. You know, for those of you familiar with Leibniz, if this sounds like Leibniz is best of all possible worlds, that is a very similar train of reasoning in here. In other words, what was Galen saying? Moses' God is free to do things outside the box in which Galen and the Greeks put their gods. In exactly the same way, the rationalists of Robert Boyle's day felt that the author of nature would never write surprise endings. Listen to these words from the preface to Isaac Newton's famous physics book. the Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, a copy of which is about a mile from here at the Lilly Library on the center of campus. The business of true philosophy, says Newton, is to derive the natures of things from causes truly existent, and to inquire after those laws on which the great creator actually chose to found this most beautiful frame of the world, not those by which he might have done the same, had he so pleased. Anyone presumptuous enough to think that he can learn the laws of nature from pure reason, said Newton, must either suppose that the world exists by necessity, and by the same necessity follows the laws proposed, or, if the order of nature was established by the will of God, that he himself, a miserable reptile, can tell what was fittest to be done, which can tell God what he had to do. I'm reminded in reading this of Niels Bohr's famous remark to Albert Einstein, once, stop telling God what to do. That's in the same spirit as some of this. Robert Boyle, who, as I've said, helped create the modern laboratory and its methods and the scientific paper as we know it today, said exactly the same thing. He put it like this: for if we believe God to be the author of things, it is rational to conceive that he may have made them commensurate rather to his own designs in them than to the notions we men may best be able to frame of them. In other words, God did things because God did things his way, because it was his world to create, not ours, in other words. He continues, he says, the author of nature consulted not in the production of things with human capacities, but first made things in such manner as he was pleased to think fit, and afterwards left human understandings to speculate as well as they could. See this fundamental difference, right, between the people who think you can learn the laws of physics, all of nature, just by sitting down in an armchair and reasoning it through, God had to have done it this way, versus the people who say, we have no idea how God would have done things. We got to go out and find out by seeing what actually took place. That's that fundamental attitudinal difference. It's a theological difference. And it actually is discussed in serious ways in those terms at that time when they're sorting out how science ought to be done. The theological component is not behind the door. It's right on the stage. Now, another example, more recent than this, comes from Michael Faraday. Many of you have heard of Michael Faraday, I bet. He's one of the greatest scientists who's ever lived and one of the most intensely religious. He was a member of a tiny, tiny little now extinct group, followers of Robert Sandeman in England. They were known as the Sandemanians. You can go read about that if you like, if you're curious. There's a wonderful biography of him by a Jewish scholar, Jeff Cantor, and it's called Faraday Sandemanian. I'm sure it's in the library here at IU, so you can go find that if you're curious. Well, another biographer of Faraday was also a Jewish scholar, though not a believing Jew, whereas Cantor is. This was Pierce Williams of Cornell. He was an atheist, but he wrote the standard biography of Faraday before Cantor's biography. Even though Pierce Williams didn't believe in God at all, he noted with admiration how Faraday drew more than strength from his religion. It gave him both a sense of the necessary unity of the universe, derived from the unity and benevolence of its creator, and a profound sense of the fallibility of man. Both are worth stressing. As he continued, he's speaking here about Faraday's work on electricity, which is known as field theory to physicists today. The origins of field theory are to be found in Faraday's detailed experimental researches on electricity. But the speculations and imaginings which led him to publish what were at the time physical heresies owe something to his unquestioning belief in the unity and interconnectedness of all phenomena. This belief, in turn, derived from his faith in God as both creator and sustainer of the universe. Again, this is said by a person who wanted nothing to do with religion himself, Pierce Williams, and in observing Faraday's work and studying his papers, this was Williams' conclusion. Now, as with each of these examples, for centuries, Christian theology has been closely linked with a humble attitude toward human knowledge and a genuine openness to finding wholly unanticipated even seemingly irrational things in nature. And this is surely conducive to doing good science. Indeed, we have an identical opinion from none other than Thomas Henry Huxley, famously known as Darwin's bulldog, for his eagerness to defend Darwin's theory of evolution when it was still a brand new idea in the mid-19th century. Now, Huxley was no Christian. He coined the word agnostic to describe his own position. But he understood that science and Christianity have at least this much in common. He put it this way. Science seems to me to teach in the highest and strongest manner the great truth which is embodied in the Christian conception of entire surrender to the will of God. Sit down before fact as a little child. Be prepared to give up every preconceived notion. Follow humbly wherever and to whatever abysses nature leads, or you shall learn nothing. Now, the relevance of the Christian understanding of creation for doing science should now be evident, but I will conclude with a complimentary observation. Doing science actually enhances the Christian life, making one a better disciple of Jesus Christ. Listen to Boyle's palpable excitement in this passage about the telescope. Though heaven be an object that has been perpetually and conspicuously exposed to man's view and curiosity for some thousands of years, yet it still affords new subjects for their wonder. And I scarce doubt that by the further improvement of telescopes, posterity will have its curiosity gratified by the discovery both of new constellations and of new stars in those constellations that are known to us already. We need not, therefore, fear that our admiration of God should expire for want of objects fit to keep it up. That boundless ocean contains a variety of excellent objects that is as little to be exhausted as the creatures that live in our sublunary ocean or lie on the shores that limit it can be numbered. Yet this even pales in comparison with the sheer rapture it fills Kepler's works from cover to cover. I confess, Kepler's my all-time favorite scientist. No question about that. I spent a whole semester with Sam Westfall, one-on-one, reading Kepler at one point, because I was thinking of doing a doctoral dissertation on him. But in those days, in order to do the to see Kepler's papers and such, I would have had to go to a place called Pukhova, which is not too far from Leningrad, okay, as it was called in those days. And not speaking a word of Russian and not wishing to be followed around by people as an American in a Soviet state, I gave up that idea. Perhaps it would be different today. Well, Kepler put it this way. For it is precisely the universe, which is that book of nature, in which God the Creator has revealed and depicted his essence and what he wills with man, in a wordless script. He wrote that in the first textbook of Copernican astronomy, the very first textbook of the solar system, printed around 1619. Or as he said on another occasion, since we astronomers are priests of the Most High God with respect to the book of nature, it behooves us that we do not aim at the glory of our own spirit, but above everything else at the glory of God. Christianity encourages scientists to seek the glory of God and the charitable service of our fellow human beings, rather than self-aggrandizement, which is indeed an ever-present danger for top scientists then and now. As Boyle, a top scientist himself, realized, the higher degree of knowledge that the scientist attains, he said, seems more likely to puff him up than to make him humble. And he noted how the challenges of laboratory life could lead to humility instead. This reminds me of Bacon's famous advice about the book of God's word and the book of God's works. Namely, he said that we should endeavor an endless progress or proficiency in both. Only let men beware that they apply both to charity, caritas, charity, loving of one's neighbor, okay, and not to ego building. To use and not to showing off. and again, that they do not act unwisely mingle or confound these learnings together. I close tonight with Boyle's advice to other scientists in an age when so many allow differences of opinion to degenerate into vulgar name-calling. I'm not talking about recent American elections. I'm talking about 17th century arguments about God and nature and everything else. Here's what Boyle said. Railing at a man's person or wrangling about his words is a quarrelsome and injurious way of writing that does very much misbecome both a philosopher and a Christian. Thanks for your kindness in listening to those remarks.